Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham, coming at you today nearly live in Ottawa, Ontario. And if you've listened to the show over the past few months, you would have heard our series of episodes from the Berkshire Conference, which was held at the University of Toronto in May. Today, we're very excited to revisit the Berks Conference a few months later with the president of the Berkshire Conference of Women Historians, who also served as the chair of the Berkshire Conference on the History of Women, Frankie Iacovetta from the University of Toronto. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Sean.
So do you want to just explain real quick the difference between those two titles for people who might be confused?
Sure, I'd be happy to. First of all, I want to thank you, and I want to thank Active History for the coverage that you gave the conference. It really was tremendous, and we really learned a lot too, especially older academics like myself who were not clued into social media sufficiently. It was a really interesting learning process for us. So I thank you for that.
Well, thank you. Yes. It was our pleasure.
Great. Okay, to explain the terms, I must say, in the very beginnings of the three-year planning cycle for the conference, one of the most serious hurdles was having to explain this title, the two titles to people, so I'm not surprised the confusion reigns still. The Berkshire Conference of Women Historians is the organization that was established in 1930. The rumblings of it, talk about it happening was taking place in the late 1920s, largely because the few women in professional history circles who were associated with the American Historical Association, for example, felt very marginalized. You know, very few of their papers were part of the program. They were seen as, in a sense, second-class citizens within the community. Most of them had been trained and taught in the women's colleges of the Northeastern U.S., and they weren't seen as, you know, bona fide professional historians like the men were. And they weren't invited to some of the key events. They weren't invited to the social events, what they used to call the smokers, which were, periods of time within conferences where the male professors and their male graduate students, you know, went to a social gathering with alcohol, with bourbon or what have you, and cigars. And it really was an important networking time.
And so like the stereotypical old boys club.
Yeah, it was very much the old boys club in action, and, you know, introducing their students, their young, you know, bright chaps to their colleagues and friends. And out of that, you know, was really important networking and hiring of people and so on and so forth. And so the story goes that in 1929, yet again, you know, the women had felt very marginalized. And on the train going home, they said, okay, I think it's time, you know, for us to meet together, you know, as women who are historians, and to network amongst ourselves, to give ourselves professional support, to talk about, you know, the work that we do as history teachers, as well as professional historians. And we're talking about women who were very serious scholars in many cases. And so they agreed that they would begin meeting on an annual basis. And the first meeting happened in 1930. Most of the meetings, which happened annually, happened in the Northeast, generally in the area of the Berkshire Mountains. And they eventually called themselves the Berkshire Conference of Women Historians. And that annual conference that, you know, officially the organization established in 1930, the annual conferences that happened since then are ongoing. So I just attended a little Berks a few weeks ago that was held in Westchester County, New York, in a very pretty wooded place, very similar to the way the annual meetings had been run from the very beginning, where the emphasis is on scholars getting to know each other. There's a lot of walking, hiking, nice food, and also some academic programming, some talks that are given, some discussion about your teaching, about, you know, a variety of things that matter to you. But it really is a kind of professional networking, professional support purpose in this case. So that's the organization. And the other thing I should say is that these women who were historians in this period were not feminists, were not historians who were, you know, researching women's history. They weren't interested in that sort of thing at all. They were overwhelmingly, you know, middle-class white women who were in some ways, you know, the daughters of liberal educated families who wanted their daughters to have, you know, a very important, serious education. But they were very homogenous, both in class and in racial terms. And they were, you know, they were studying topics like constitutional law, you know, British, early modern British history, other kinds of histories, not women's history at all. They would have balked at the idea of being called, you know, a feminist or a proto-feminist. They, you know, pretty much operated as an organization in the ways in which I've described it until we got the really important generation, you know, in late 1960s, the 1970s, the generation of women who came to history largely as feminists, women who, you know, became radicalized by second wave, you know, what historians now call second wave feminism, the women's liberation movements, other feminist movements of the late 60s and early 70s. These were women who had been activists on their, you know, campus and so forth, and who saw themselves, right, as involved in this intellectual and political project of doing women's history, right, of recovering women from the past, right, writing books that had titles like, you know, Finding the Majority's Past and so forth, right? So that's, you know, primarily Americans we're talking about here, but, you know, people like Linda Gordon, who wrote very important early women's history, others, Alice Kistler Harris and others who became very important to this process of, you know, creating the field, right? Creating the field of inquiry that became known as women's history. And that generation is the generation that began talking about the need to, in addition to the annual meeting, they talked about the need to have a conference that reflected, you know, intellectually and in scholarly ways, the work that they were doing as scholars, which was, you know, both, you know, research, it was scholarly, it was political, it was, you know, intellectual, it was engaged, it was active history, mm-hmm. right, of that time. And there were initially tensions between the two generations of women, because the early generation wasn't interested, you know, in running a women's history conference. And there were debates about it. And eventually it got resolved in, you know, a couple of ways. One was for the annual meeting to continue to happen, and to which, you know, all women were invited. And that became known as the Little Birks. And then the conference eventually became the triennial conference that became known as the Big Birks. And that conference was named the Berkshire Conference on the History of Women. So that helps explain the two titles.
Okay. And I mean, would it not have been easier to come up with a different name for the triennial conference? Because the only difference is a conference of women historians and conference on the history of women. They're very similar titles.
They are similar titles. I think that the first title really was meant to reflect the fact that you were welcome to this organization regardless of what kind of history you did. Mm-hmm. But it was conceived of as a conference of women who are historians. And it is interesting because now, as we, you know, reflect on the fact that the conference, like the scholarship in the field, has evolved. So the conference now is not only the single most important international conference on the history of women, it's also the most important conference on the history of gender and sexuality. And for a number of years now, people have been talking about the need to change the title of the conference to more accurately reflect the changes that are happening in the field. And, you know, a recognition that these three fields that are interrelated are also not identical, and there are some serious debates, you know, between them, between the advocates and the practitioners of them, but that they clearly have a relationship to each other, and that the conference has come to represent, you know, those three fields. Some aren't entirely happy with that. They wanted to remain a women's history conference. Others have said, you know, well, I will continue to do women's history. I really think it's important, you know, that the growing presence of gender and sexuality scholars and the growing attention to this, and the fact that those fields have also, whether we want, you know, to what extent we want to acknowledge it is up to us, but that those newer fields have also impacted women's history and how we research and write women's history. So I also faced the hurdle of explaining to people that I was the president, the first Canadian president of the Berkshire Conference of Women Historians, and I was hosting this conference on the Berkshire History Berkshire Conference on the History of Women, which over the years has also evolved into the History of Women, Gender, and Sexuality. So that was a mouthful to start off these meetings for me. And I could say now, I can report quite happily that as of a few weeks ago at the Little Berks, which is also the place where the annual general meeting takes place, so some, you know, serious decisions are made about the organization. And we voted unanimously and with very positive and enthusiastic manner to change the title of the conference to the Berkshire Conference on the History of Women, Genders, and Sexualities.
Oh, wow.
So we know a lot of people will be pleased with that because we had been talking about it for a long while.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to fit just because those are all issues that historically have been maybe marginalized in the historiography.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, I think given, you know, how the women's history exploded as a field and the scholarship now is so, you know, the literature is so extensive, it's maybe hard to imagine, right, that this was really once a very, very marginalized field, as was, you know, as was gender and sexuality. So, yes, it is. You know, it's a conference that emerged out of a sense to find a place for an emerging but marginal field. And to me, it's just extraordinary. Who would have predicted? I don't think very many people could have predicted that the field of women's history could have become as enormous as it is, and the scholarship as you know, as extensive as it is. But it's the gender and sexuality, of course, also fields that exploded, lots of important work getting done.
And you could see that just in the number of people who were at the conference. It was huge. And
yes,
I'd never been to a Berks before, and I'd actually never heard of it until it was the CHA in 2012 in Waterloo. I was at the media and communications business meeting, and Mary Vipon brought it up and said the Berks is coming to Toronto, and she mentioned it in that meeting. It was the first time I had ever heard of it. And then I went, and this thing was bigger than anything I'd ever been to. And well, first, let's talk about the process of you getting involved with the University of Toronto. What made you want to bring this to Canada and to the University of Toronto, given how big it is and how much of an undertaking it would be for you personally?
Right. That's a great question, Sean. I might continue to ask that question of myself for the next number of years. I should answer the question first by saying that it is interesting that, you know, there was this kind of mystique about the Berks among, you know, a number of Canadian women historians. And it's been wonderful to see that now a lot more people know about it and that it's not confined to the women historians. What in my case, I was part of a group of Canadians that started going to the Berks. Well, some of them started going before me in the late 1970s. The triennial conference that became known as the Big Berks, or the Berkshire Conference on the History of Women, started up in the early 1970s. And I know some of the historians, some of Canada's senior historians like Ruth Roach Pearson, went for the first time in the late 1970s and was really, really struck by it. I mean, for someone like her, it was transformative. She was not a women's historian until she went to the Berks. Mm-hmm. And she had been trained as a German historian. And as she was, because of having gotten a job in Canada at Memorial, then later she ended up at U of T OISE, she was beginning to retool herself as a Canadian historian. And the Berks changed her life. And she said, I went from not knowing, you know, what women's history was to knowing that I wanted to become a women's historian, and then went on to write one of the first and still influential monographs in the field on Canadian women and the Second World War. They're still women after all. I was part of a kind of group of Canadians who started going in the early 1980s. And at first as a graduate student, with other graduate students who were part of, you know, my kind of generation of scholars doing their PhDs at the time, people like Ruth Frager and others. And, you know, that's where we met people like Bettina Bradbury and Andre Levesque and so forth, who were bringing their students to the Berks and so on. So, but we were a small group. I mean, we, you know, Constance Backhouse was part of this group too of Canadians. So we were the sort of small group of Canadians who were going. And initially for me, I shouldn't speak for others, but you know, for me, it was very much to kind of watch. And there was a lot of stargazing, right? About, you know, seeing in person the scholars whose work we were reading and whose work was very transformative for us in terms of becoming, you know, feminist historians. And so, you know, seeing Linda Gordon for the first time, all of us in awe of seeing Natalie Zeman Davis for the first time. And Natalie gave, you know, she gave a paper at the very first Berks that ever happened in 1973. Seeing Carol Smith Rosenberg, seeing others who were such important scholars to the, you know, the building of the field. And we did a lot of that. You know, we saw Deborah Gray White, who wrote that really important Ain't I a Woman book on that really was a rethinking of slavery through the lens, you know, of women and gender. It was, you know, for us, it was just wonderful. And it took a while. It took a number of Berks before we began to, you know, submit proposals and to get onto the program. And so for us, the Berks was very important. It was important to our scholarly development, our intellectual development, and also to the kind of professional networking that happens at conferences. And that was my, you know, introduction to the Berks and how I became more involved in the organization, not so much in terms of the little Berks, in terms of the actual organization of the, you know, not so much in terms of the running of the organization as a whole, but the big Berks. The big Berks is what really stood out. But I got to know people. I got invited to be on roundtables that talked about the state of the field, you know, in your country, right? I got to be Canada, what's happening in Canada in relation to questions either about women's history or more recently about transnationalizing and gendering, right, meta-narratives and national historiographies and so forth. So all of that's been a really important process for me, and it's helped give me also a you know, international exposure and so forth. So you asked me how I you asked me why did I bring the big Berks to Canada, and really I have to say initially that I made no effort to go to the Berks and try to bring it to Canada at all, but they came to me. And so the nomination committee of the Berkshire Conference of Women Historians, the organization, came to me and asked me if I would be interested in put forward for the presidency of the organization, and would I be interested in hosting the Big Berks, which is something that, you know, the president usually does. And they said the two were not necessarily combined, but they did come together pretty much. And so I was absolutely flabbergasted. I had no idea that this was in the works, that they were going to ask me this. I was very flattered and was very honored, but also I was immediately a little anxious too, because I knew it was a huge job. I knew that I couldn't take on the position of president and a first Canadian president of the organization without throwing myself into it. So I had to think about what this meant. I had to think about the fact that it meant that it was going to interrupt a book that I was working on and that I'm only now getting back to, that it was going to really take a huge chunk of time and energy, you know, out of my life, out of my professional life, and probably my personal life to do it. But I also thought, yes, this makes sense. You know, it's about time. There had been talk, you know, that the Berks needs to move too, the big Berks especially, but the Berks needs to better reflect the growing international character and the fact that, you know, its various efforts to internationalize, to bring in people outside what a very narrowly defined notion of women historian was. And it made sense that the first border they'd want to cross was into Canada. I thought, as someone whose own scholarly life had been positively affected by the Burkes. This made sense. I thought, as someone who spent a lot of time training graduate students and young scholars to become historians, this made sense. As someone who felt, you know, that I was a kind of outsider initially to professional history, but who had, you know, pretty much embraced it, that it made sense. And I have to say that, you know, the really strong reaction in favor was, wow, wouldn't it be fantastic, right, to bring the Burkes to Canada? Wouldn't it be great, right, to have the big Burkes in Canada? And when I told people that this was a possibility, that was always their reaction. That was almost always was, wow, bringing the Burkes to Canada, wow, that's going to be fantastic. That's amazing. So there was the sense, you know, that the big Burkes, it's such a significant conference for so many of us that that's what won me over.
When we were at the conference in the spring, they announced that it was going to be in New York. So obviously that decision had already been made. So when did you find out, or when did they ask you, when did you agree? And how long of a process was it to put this thing together?
Well, they asked me sometime in the, you know, spring of 2011. And once I agreed, we quickly went into action because they, you know, very rightly said, you know, talk to some of your key people, your administrators at the University of Toronto, to see whether they were interested. And I did. And I went initially to my dean, who is an American historian, Rick Halpern, who came out of graduate school at a time when women's history was very strong, and as someone who knew that while he himself was not a woman or gender historian, he knew about the Burkes and he knew that it was important and significant, and that he too thought it would be, you know, a kind of coup to be able to bring it to Canada and bring it to the University of Toronto. So after a few weeks of talking to various administrators and getting very positive responses, also the history department, other folks, I went back and said, okay, yes, I will stand for it. So they knew going into the last big, the big Burkes before 2014, 2011, in early June 2011 at UMass Amherst. By that point, they knew that I was becoming president and that the big Burkes was going to move to Toronto. And that was unusual. What I understand is historically, they often didn't know. It's only now been twice that they've been able to announce who the next president is and where the next big Burkes will be. That usually what happened was a lot of energy was put into organizing, you know, the big Burkes, and then they had to sort of think, okay, now we have to get moving, you know, with the new president and new Burkes and so forth. So I don't know whether or not it means we're getting more organized or whether these two Burkes in a row were a fluke. I don't know, but it's actually nice to know that. To know what's going to happen next and to build on the momentum of the conference that you're at. So I'm glad that could happen.
Well, even just having the opportunity to be at the conference before, knowing that you're organizing the next one.
Like
it's one thing to be there, but it's another to be there with the gaze of, well, I'm doing this next time. What do I need to know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It did mean that for me, UMass Amherst, I was giving a paper on the work I do on transnational anti-fascist exile women, a paper I was doing on this woman, D'Andrea. But that's not where my, you know, I had my paper, I delivered it, it was great, but experience was great. But really, I became a different kind of participant. I was observing things. I was looking at, you know, what the size of the receptions were like. I was asking people about, you know, how did you put this together? Talk to the, you know, the graduate student who put the book exhibit on display and so forth, you know, but how the logistics worked and so on. And then at the end of that conference, I went to the business meeting and also had a series of short meetings with a number of different, you know, groups of organizers for the conference. So, yes, I went very much into that kind of organizing mode and trying to suss out, you know, how does one put something this big on?
And I mean, based on the number of people you brought up on stage at the president's address, it was a huge team.
Yes, it was a huge team. I mean, you asked me about the time, and really, I have to say it's a 3-year planning cycle. It's a long time, and it's a lot of work. And you know, initially, it begins with a kind of low-level work, you know, that you need to do, which is knocking on doors and telling people about the conference. I mean, again, because, you know, one of the things I had in my favor was the, you know, the weight of the conference for people who knew. There were enough people, you know, in Canada who knew, you know, about the conference, who'd been there, who understood its importance. So I could have initial meetings, you know, by just announcing, you know, anybody interested should come to a meeting, you know, in the history department, and we'll start talking about it. I immediately went to the Canadian Committee on Women's History at the CHA. To say I'd like to put a proposal forward that the CCWH, the Canadian Committee on Women's History, become the national sponsor for the conference. I mean, there were people and places where, given the importance of women's history and gender and sexuality history, that I could turn to say, do you want to be involved? But I also had to talk to a lot of people who'd never heard about it before. And I knocked on a lot of doors. I went to not only women and gender studies institutes and centers. They knew about the BERC, so that was great. But I went to the kinds of departments that ran programs that could help us with a more inclusive program, I thought, with, you know, an indigenous program, with a more global program. So turning to the center, you know, Centers for the Study of South Asia, for Southeast Asia, our CHU program in Pacific Asia, and so forth, that turning to those folks and saying, this is what the BERC is. And again, some of them knew, but some of them didn't. This is what it is. And I think we can work on a mutually beneficial arrangement so that you get the kind of speakers you want at this conference, and we get the kind of speakers, you know, that we want. And that was a lot of work. I did a lot of that work initially on my own, but I also very well knew I needed a huge team. And so I also began putting together a program committee. Before I even did that, I put together, you know, simply through email and contacting people and asking them if they'd be interested, I put together a kind of brainstorming committee. Mm-hmm. And created, I didn't create it, a colleague helped me create a wiki site where we could do some brainstorming about what kinds of things did we want for this conference, what kinds of themes did we want. And there were about 100 people on that wiki site, so it was an interesting process. And I had never, you know, run a wiki site before, so I was learning all of this. I thank my colleague Natalie Rothman at U of T for the help on this. So it was clear from the beginning that I wanted to be as consultative as I could be. I didn't want this big BERC to be simply a U of T event or a Toronto event, but I wanted to think about it as a Canadian-wide hosting event, and I wanted it to be a global and transnational event. And so I tried to consult as much as I could. The brainstorming that came out of that initial committee came up with many of the themes for the conference, and the notion of histories on the edge became a kind of umbrella concept. Then I turned to a program committee that was just tremendous. I mean, I you know, absolutely tremendous. My program co-chairs, the four of them, usually the BERCs, big BERCs has two, I had four. They were tremendous. I mean, Molly Ladd-Taylor was tremendous. She was in many ways the person who had the most direct link to the American historians, who also then worked on women and gender and health and medical history broadly defined. Joe Sharma, my colleague in South Asian history at U of T, had the global networks, especially in connection with Asia, and she worked extremely hard. Aline Charles, who's a Francophone Quebec historian, gender, women, worked very hard on the Quebec and Francophone part, and was really important in terms of even French language, because we recognized that we were primarily an English language program, but we really did want to have French content. We chose to create a bilingual website and so forth, and she was very important to all of that. And then Adele Perry, whose, you know, work in Aboriginal history and Aboriginal white settler relations was very important. But the program committee, they were tremendous. I mean, I invited people I knew, and I invited people I didn't know, who I knew by reputation. And we couldn't have pulled off a program that had the LGBT content it had, that had the Indigenous content and the global content, without the 75-person program committee. They were tremendous. And I have to say, in terms of the Indigenous stream, Susan Hill and Mary Jane McCallum were tremendous. They were proactive about not just the Indigenous content, but Indigenous scholars presenting their work at the conference. So I was really helped. And then there was the army of people who were, you know, largely U of T based, who were the various administrative assistants, the coordinators of the students who did the poster sessions, the website master and assistant, the program coordinator. I mean, there was the cultural coordinator. I mean, these people became such an important part of the process. They were the core team. And we met on a very regular basis. In addition, you know, we trained and mentored a number of other grad students to do different pieces of the conference, whether it was on the film piece or dealing with the disability stream. It really was an enormous project. And I really did feel like I was in a position of kind of, in addition to my own graduate students, you know, supervising and mentoring, I was also supervising and mentoring, you know, a much larger group of graduate students and new scholars. But I couldn't have done it without them. They were tremendous.
And one of them was Jen Evans, who I know from my time at Nipissing University, and she wrote a piece for us at Active History in the lead up to the conference, just talking about the process of it. You know, and like you say, sort of that younger people who are starting to get into the field, that initiation to this type of conference would be very helpful.
Yes. I mean, it was really interesting to watch that process. I mean, you know, at the beginning, it was just simply vague. You know, it was vague. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. We're going to start talking about this. We're going to start. But as we were, you know, going through the process, you could really see how they were making sense of it all and how they became such important players in the process. Jen is a perfect example. I mean, Jen was and is my PhD student. She's finished drafting her thesis, so she's going to defend soon, and that'll be wonderful. Mm-hmm. But she, you know, began with needing to learn about the organization. She'd never been to a Berks before. We recruited her into a working group we had at the Jackman Humanities Institute that we were using as a kind of planning the Berks. One of the places where we were dealing with planning the Berks and also talking about sort of gender and global scholarship, bringing in former Berks people to talk about some of these issues. And she just rose to the occasion and learned a lot and became very, very important person who coordinated so much of the graduate content for the conference, who became, you know, a really central player. And she learned an enormous amount. I mean, the conversations that she was in on, along with the others, about the planning, even about, you know, kind of political, intellectual issues around equity. You know, we have a Berks rule that you can only present, you know, one paper at the Berks. You know, basically, you can only have one serious spot at the Berks. And the point of that is it's an inclusivity rule. It's to prevent, you know, the senior people from being all over the program. It means that, you know, you have to have more people on the program because no one can dominate the program. Mm. And then to see us play it out, where we had to tell very senior people, the leading people in these fields, that, sorry, you have to make a choice. You know, you've been accepted. You know, your proposal, of course, you're attached to more than one proposal because everybody wants you. Mm-hmm. But you can only be on it once. You can be on it again as a chair or commentator, but you can only give one presentation. And, you know, initially they're sort of, you know, their jaws dropped open and said, we're going to tell so-and-so that she can only do the program once. And we said, yes, we're going to tell her. And here's the reasoning. And every time we made a decision, we worked out the logic. And for Jen, it was important because she was answering a lot of the emails that were coming in, an enormous volume of emails, you know, under the rubric of the Berks, you know, organizing committee. But a lot of those were hers, her replies. And, you know, we had templates of the various, you know, explanations that we worked through as a group. And I think she found all of that, you know, really, really interesting. And the politics of doing a massive international conference, which is complicated by feminist politics, because issues of inclusivity and of direct mentoring and of having activism as well as scholarship on the program is very central, right, to the process. It's not a strictly narrowly defined historians conference.
Well, I think that sort of leads into the overall theme that you had of histories on the edge, And you famously were part of a group of historians who proudly declared that you had killed Canadian history after that after that book came out over a decade ago now, that which is fresh in my mind because I'm teaching a historiography course right now at the University of Ottawa, and we talked about that book and the response to it a couple of weeks ago. So your response of declaring how you had contributed to the killing of Canadian history as defined by Jack Granstein is fresh. But, you know, given that context of your career, you know, is that history's on the edge, that theme, this notion of sort of getting outside of the narrowly defined areas, even within something like the history of or women's history, you know, mm-hmm. broadening that out, was that really one of your major focuses in putting together this conference?
Yes. I mean, it's interesting that we came up with the kind of the umbrella theme of histories on the edge, because that wasn't mine. It came out of this brainstorming, but it certainly, I mean, I reacted to it immediately because it seemed to fit so perfectly what the discussions had been about. And I had been part of those discussions, that what we wanted to do, certainly, we wanted to continue the Burke's tradition of writing histories that had historically been marginalized, right, and bringing them closer to the center, and also making the argument that by doing these histories, we could also change the way in which, you know, the meta-narratives are told and the way in which history more broadly would be written. And I think that's true, right? I think that even people outside these fields have been affected in some ways about it, even, you know, gendering military history and so forth. So we knew we wanted to do that. We knew that continuing to bring the margins towards the center was really important. But we also knew the sense of what the margins were, you know, changes, and that we knew that women's history, you know, is in a different place now than it was 30 years ago. And that other fields like LGBT histories, indigenous histories and so forth, that people talked about, you know, the importance of being able to make those more central to a big Burke's conference and in an ongoing way. I mean, we also, I have to admit, took very seriously the fact that it was the first time in Canada, and that, in many ways, Canada sits on the edge of the America, of the United States, of the American Empire, and that, you know, we're the hegemony of, you know, the American scholarly, you know, weight is just so, you know, it's so extraordinary that we had a sense of that, too, that we were, you know, we were on the edge of the United States. We thought in terms of disability history, as because people talked about what don't I normally see in a very significant and meaningful way at the Big Burke's? And these kinds of, you know, ideas came out: disability history, Indigenous history. It's not that the Burke's had never tried to bring those scholars before, they had. But our discussion was about the need to go beyond inviting a few individual people in those fields to sort of talk to what was still a mainstream audience of heavily American women historians, and that we needed to find a way to create a critical mass of people who write and are very central to what I'm going to put in quotation marks, still marginalized histories. And that really, Sean, became so critical because it shaped so much of what we did. I mean, we said, okay, we want to be more inclusive. We want to make sure the LGBT stream is more central than it has been in the past. We want to be global. We want to make sure that histories that cross borders and so forth are a more significant part of the Burke's programming. But we also knew you can't just say you want to be global and expect to cover the world evenly. That would have been silly. I mean, we would have just, you know, got a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and it would have been as tokenistic as anything else we had thought about critiquing. So that's also why we decided that with respect to the global, we would actually highlight, you know, areas where there had been representation at former Burke's, but not in a really significant way. And that it was, these were places where we could begin, right, to move these histories more to the center of the Burke's in the long term, we hoped. So that meant, if for us, we chose Latin America and the Caribbean, we chose Asia, we chose Indigenous histories as well. And we worked hard to say, how do you create a critical mass? How do you create a critical mass? And one way in which you do it is you really have to commit your funds to it. You really have to commit space on the program to it. So we said, you know, equal spaces will happen in the case of indigenous scholars who are giving papers, in the case of Caribbean, and so on. And that when the submissions started coming in, the fact that there were far more submissions for streams where the proposals were coming from heavily from American scholars that were heavily American in focus. Of course, many of them got accepted. They were excellent proposals. They still were the numerical majority at the conference, but we chose to ensure that equal numbers of papers and sessions were coming from these other fields, were coming from these other scholars. And then in my fundraising, in the, you know, the SHRC grant application, which happily was successful and so forth, we stressed that we were using this money, we were flagging it for scholars, you know, from the global south, especially Asia and Latin America, but we also supported some people coming from Africa and elsewhere, and that we had made a, you know, essentially a political decision that was also a scholarly and intellectual one, that we would put our resources there. And it was really important. It was really important. And it meant for us that in some ways, we were performing a kind of political professional service, saying, because we understood, like we recognized that the scholars who do those other histories, they don't want to be one of three scholars at the Berks. Right. They want to also be with each other. They also want to talk to each other, mm-hmm. as well as talk to us. And it did mean that being able to do some of that, I wish we could have done more, but it meant that the feel of the conference was different. It meant that the people at the conference really were more diverse than they had been in the past. And that was really important. And we, you know, we passed that on to the 2017 organizers and said, you know, we hope that we can continue to build, you know, on the kind of relationships that we formed, on the kind of networking that we did. Because we thought, you know, our decision to have one plenary in the conference and to make it the Indigenous plenary, we were very pleased we did so, because we think the Indigenous plenary really was a major highlight of the conference.
And I mean, I went to a disability panel, and I went to a couple on the Caribbean history. I agree. It seemed like there were these niches, but they fit within the wider sphere of the conference. So, like you say, I mean, if you have three people from a specific area, the panel is going to be those three people and maybe one other person, right? But right. These panels were all very well attended, and it struck me being on campus that week. Now, I haven't spent a significant amount of time at the University of Toronto, so I don't know what a normal day at the University of Toronto is like, but it struck me that there was a lot of energy on campus, particularly in the buildings where the conference was being held, and that there was an excitement to it. And right. For anyone who's never been to the University of Toronto, the downtown campus, it's rather large. Yes. And I think I personally was in four or five different buildings through the course of the conference. And in each one, you know, people were excited to be there, and especially around University College, where everything was centered.
Right.
There was people around, there was conversations, and there was an excitement to it that was contagious, frankly.
Thank you. Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, there is always this kind of, you know, as Bettina Bradbury put it, there is always this kind of buzz coming from this conference, you know, where so many people, you know, it's like they're, you know, they're really, really important conference. And I think, you know, there's a real sense of excitement. But we really felt it. I mean, if anything, it was at first it was a bit scary, because we were completely thrown by how many people came to Thursday, which was the slow day.
Right.
And just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who showed up even before the registration desk had been set up at 8 a.m. And we were scrambling, you know, for chairs, for bigger rooms, for these workshops, you know, on the day that was sort of the day that people kind of dribble in and we were concerned. So it took
that Thursday afternoon in the basement of whatever room that or building that was.
Yes.
There were so many people down there. It was incredible.
It was, to us, it was incredible. And it took us a while to realize the good news, because we were scrambling, worried about, right, the need for more chairs and rooms, thinking, oh my God, like this is, you know, a disaster. And then realizing, well, no, actually, this is a real success.
Yeah.
And then the energy that was sustained over the course of the 4 days, I mean, it was tremendous. We felt great. We think, we think the buildings helped, as you said, especially University College and Hart House. Partly because we didn't have a lot of great big lecture halls. And so there were smaller rooms that got packed, and we felt badly for the people who didn't get in them. But I do think it meant that it added to the excitement. It added to the sense that this was an event. We saw people in the hallways talking to each other. It was beautiful weather, so people were outside talking to each other. The lunch events were so successful. The coffee break event with Ursula Franklin. I heard your podcast with Ann Miller, and that was tremendously successful. The Feminist Mentors event at lunchtime, which had over 100 people, we just were so thrilled. I mean, the program co-chairs and other key organizers, the cultural coordinator Sarah Amato, and so forth. We just kept saying to each other, this is great. This is great. We felt so good, and people were so positive, and people kept coming up to us to tell us it was fantastic. Veteran Berks people who have organized big Berks in the past, who are so central to the organization, were tremendously positive. You know, some people said the best Berks ever. It should be at Toronto every year. You know, those kinds of things. It was great. And by Friday and Saturday, we were really enjoying ourselves. So it was great. But I also have to say, I began by thanking Active History and you for the coverage of the Berks, but I also wanted to comment on you in particular, because I listened to the podcasts that you did with Cynthia Enloe and Ann Miller and Vereen Shepherd, and I was really struck by how much you became engaged by the conference. I mean, in a way, you were our ideal candidate, right? I mean, someone who didn't know about the Berks, mm-hmm. who doesn't, see himself, I assume, as an historian of women or gender, or sexuality particularly, but, got this gig to come to the Berks. And, in some ways it seemed to be, I'll use the word transformative, but you yourself talked about how you didn't expect this conference to affect you intellectually particularly, mm-hmm. or affect how you looked at your research or looked at yourself as an historian. And I thought your conversations with those scholars were absolutely fantastic.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And it's true. I went expecting to go to some panels and try and get some interviews and see people who, see someone like Jen, who I haven't seen in a while, and sort of catch up with people who I knew from past experiences, who I could just catch up with, old friends sort of thing. And that's the way I viewed it. And then I got there, and it was the Thursday afternoon, and it was the economics panel that Cynthia mm-hmm. Enloe was on with. It was after I couldn't get into one of those working groups or whatever the
workshops.
Excuse me. I couldn't get into one because there were so many people down in the basement there. So I went to the other panel and I was really taken aback by, the energy there sort of draws you in mm-hmm. in a way that, let's be honest, other conferences don't have that energy to it. And so you're sort of stimulated intellectually that way. And then the contents and just the idea of, most of it that struck me was the questions that were being asked so much as the answers, right? Because, again, I don't study gender or mm-hmm. women specifically or sexuality or anything, although these issues obviously play a role in broadcasting, so I have to address them. But mm-hmm. So the content and the answers, maybe not as much, but the questions that these people are asking about their work and say, well, what if you looked at it this way or this way or this way? That's really interesting to me. And mm-hmm. that's really where I was struck by the notion of, and I think the episode with Cynthia Enloe mm-hmm. encapsulated it perfectly. Mm-hmm. Why not look at it from a gendered perspective? Mm-hmm. Because these things are relevant, and even if it's not, maybe gender specific, looking at it from that way can lead you to answers that maybe you didn't expect, and it can force just a reinterpretation of what's going on, and we can get away from traditional methods or traditional interpretations, and that's really what struck me, mm-hmm. and it was really a lot of fun to get into it. I mean, I took a women's history course in my undergrad. But I felt in the room there, and this is not meant to be a reflection of the person who taught that course or mm-hmm. of Nipissing University, but there was 50 people registered. There was two men in the room, and I felt marginalized to the point where I didn't really even want to be active in the class. mm-hmm. because I felt whenever I was dismissed. Maybe symbolically that is actually a good thing, because for thousands of years, women were dismissed. So maybe there's something fitting in that. But this conference was so much different in that I didn't feel like an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
I felt welcomed in, and which is something I was concerned about.
Right.
I thought it'd be, you know, 1,000 women and then me at this thing. And people would be looking at me like, what are you doing here? Why are you here? And it wasn't right. like that at all.
Right.
And so once I got there and realized that it would be like that. Now, it's, granted, I was definitely in the minority in terms of gender.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't in the minority of, or was it, but I wasn't, you know, looked at weird or like, why are you here, or dismissed at all. And so once I felt welcomed, and I'm sort of realizing that there's this great diversity of what's going on, and maybe a way to take some of these questions and put them into my own stuff. It was really quite a remarkable experience for me. And like you say, I might be, because I think I talked with Ann Miller about this. I mean, I think I am maybe the target audience, because the people who are already going and are already into this line of work, they're going to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
And they know what's going on. People like me, who had no idea what this conference was before 2012, if you can get people like us in, it maybe broadens it and it brings a whole new meaning to the thing, I think.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, that all of that is really important to think about. I mean, there was a time, you know, when it was all women. And, you know, when Bettina Bradbury, you know, commented on the buzz one gets from, you know, just going to a conference in which there are all women and such a large gathering of them, that was more important, you know, to women earlier on, when, you know, we were working in a field that didn't, you know, didn't necessarily have the same status as more traditional fields like Jack Ranstein's military history. But I also think, and Bettina would agree, she was someone who was very, you know, central to the organizing as well, is that as we enjoy a level of, you know, status and prestige, I think, now in the profession, that our own desire to be inclusive means, you know, to be precisely, to act precisely in the ways you're suggesting. I mean, initially there was a sprinkling of men who started coming largely because of the rise and growing importance of lesbian and gay history. So men doing gay history, George Chauncey, for example, you know, at one point, you know, gave a kind of central address, which was, you know, pretty much announcing that the history of masculinity and that the history of gay lesbian lives and so forth was becoming a significant aspect. Now, the presence of men has grown further as, you know, different kinds of gender histories are being written. And so people who write about, you know, heterosexual men as well, and then the growing presence of sexuality history, because the field has become so important. Now, there's overlap between all of those things. But I certainly think that the conference should be open to all sorts of people, to the Sean Grahams of the world, and that it could really have a tremendous effect, and it could really create really interesting conversations. One of the things I did at one point was to talk to, there were male graduate students who were involved in the organizing. We had men who were volunteers of the conference, many of them from U of T and from York. We had lots of grad student interest and support through York and some other organizations. But at one point, I went and talked to male graduate students in the graduate history program at U of T who were not going to the Mercs, and just chatted with them about what their projects were on, right? And one of them said, well, I work on, you know, Jewish family rituals around death. And I said, oh, well, you know, actually thinking about women and gender in relation to family rituals of death actually would be really interesting. Here are some of the kinds of sessions that we have on the program, including the fair bit of Jewish history, which was on the program. And I did that with a number of people. Someone was talking about, they do the Cold War in Poland. And I said, oh, well, I'm a Cold War historian. And here's some things you might want to do. And, you know, we did that at one point. The Jen played a role in this. We set up a kind of, you know, contest and said, if you can tell us why, you know, you might come to the Berks even though you don't think the Berks is for you. Just write up something. And, you know, if we find it interesting, we'll give you a free pass to the Berks. So we did do that in a number of cases. So that was, you know, that was great. And, you know, in terms of your course at Nipissing, I'm not going to comment on that, obviously. But to make a link, I, you know, as someone who in my upper level seminars tends to have mostly women in her seminars, I have very mixed gender, lecture classes, but I teach things like, you know, women's history at the upper level and immigrant women and diaspora and so forth. And I get, you know, mostly women and one or two guys in the classroom who usually find it, you know, they find it interesting by the end. But this year I was teaching my fourth year seminar in Cold War Canada and the United States. And for the first time in a long time, I had a seminar that was primarily male, and there were 12 of us, 10 men, 2 women. And I thought that's interesting because I'd got accustomed to mostly women in the upper level seminars. And I also was, you know, I also had to tell them, okay, if you're here because you care about foreign policy and spies, that's great, but we're also doing suburbia and sexuality and LGBT histories and popular culture, homemaker ideology and all those things. So I hope you're going to stick around for it. And it was great. It was interesting to see, you know, to see us make the shift. You know, we did begin very much, you know, with what was the Cold War consensus, containment of communism, you know, so on and so forth. And we certainly dealt with Korean War and Vietnam and so on. But we also did, you know, a lot of social history and cultural history. We did a whole session on Cold War films where I told everybody to bring a 10-minute clip of a Cold War film that they'd watched, which turned out to be a lot of fun. And I think it was an interesting experience for them and for me, you know, to present some of the topics like sexuality, like showing the film, the NFB Forbidden Love on Lesbian Lives in 1950s and 60s Canada. When you teach it to a virtually, you know, a more male class than a female class, it does change the dynamic. It makes it interesting. I really enjoyed teaching the course, and a number of the men said to me, you know, I'm glad I took the course. I'm glad you forced us to think outside, you know, the politics narrowly defined.
But I guess that leads to an issue of if the Berks is successful and continues to expand the way it does, does it not run the risk of making itself irrelevant? If the Berks, it strikes me that maybe the ultimate goal of this conference is to make it so that the conference isn't necessary anymore. To have a place that specifically for women's history, gender history, sexuality history, this history that has been marginalized, if the conference is successful, these things will no longer be marginalized.
Right.
And then therefore you don't need a place to discuss the marginalized. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. This is a bit of how many angels can dance on the tip of the pin.
That's right, yeah.
But if you finally get to the center, then you're everywhere and therefore nowhere. It's a good question. But no, I don't think so. I think that what will happen, you know, I don't imagine we'll have the whole world coming to the Big Berks. There is an issue that the Big Berks is big, and therefore the job of mounting the Big Berks is an enormous job. At some point, you know, if things become so big, do we lose some of that excitement and energy that is happening? I think what will happen is, you know, the Big Berks will continue to be big, but I think that there will continue to be, you know, important political debates, important, you know, activism issues that need to be addressed, that it will evolve in a variety of different ways. I do think that it enjoys a place closer to the center than it ever did before, historically speaking. And but also the Big Berks itself is being challenged in terms of its own you know, now success, and that, you know, as I was talking about earlier, that we can no longer run a Big Berks that says, you know, this is primarily a conference of American historians, you know, writing about U.S. history. That if it's really going to be more inclusive, then it will be, you know, it will continue to be a different kind of Big Berks. I fully admit, too, that there will be some tensions around that, because there's no question that the Big Berks, you know, was a creation of the United States. And numerically speaking, they still are the majority and dominant at the conference. If money isn't put out there to help people from elsewhere come, we may not always have, you know, the degree of global coverage that we did in Toronto. Will everybody keep coming? I don't know. I think it's such an important conference for those people who are in women and gender and sexuality history that will continue to be the core group. But I hope, you know, that it will always attract people from elsewhere, because as you yourself acknowledged in some of your podcasts, that even calling the conference Women, Gender, and Sexuality doesn't immediately tell you that all sorts of histories are going to be told through that lens. Right. So as you said, lots of health history was on there, right? Mm-hmm. And sexuality histories were also actually histories of, you know, medieval and early modern history, as well as modern history, that there were so many different kinds of histories that were on the program that were, you know, being approached through the lens of women, gender, and sexuality, but our medieval histories and our border crossing histories, right, our transnational migration histories, that are oral histories, right? We had a tremendous, right, number of oral history panels that tell so many different kinds of histories, right, through oral history. And so out of the BERTs are a variety of projects. I mean, there are theme issues for journals and various book projects that people are now working away at that will, you know, be in some ways, you know, take place in different locales and different venues of journals that do different things, whether they're, you know, more oriented regionally towards Asia or whether they're thematic, as in, you know, a woman's history or a gender history journal. I myself am working with the people who were part of the Louisa Pasadini panel on oral history and feminist ethics and so forth, turning that into a theme issue of the Women's History Review and other projects. So I think that the people who will take up that work will continue to be scholars who identify themselves primarily as women, gender, and sexuality historians. But that is work that continues. It's part of their professional lives, is very much part of who, you know, who they are and what they do. But I hope that the Big BERTs as a conference can continue to attract people who've never been before, attract people who go out of curiosity or because they're assigned the gig of covering it, and can really see how these histories, as you said, are both histories of recovery, of subjects of lives, you know, that haven't historically been highlighted or centered, but also they are about brilliant scholars who take up these analytical questions that really, as you said, can rewrite how we think about history more broadly. I mean, we can go back to Nikki Strongbog and, you know, the very first Rethinking Canada, the promise of women's history, right, was to not just recover women's lives, but rethink, right, what history is and who gets to be an historian. You know, Mary Jane McCallum with Indigenous History has talked about, you know, who gets to be seen as a real historian, who gets to be part of the historical profession. Those questions and then the actions that come out of it are prompted by, right, gender questions. Mm-hmm. And I think the BERTs can continue to be provocative. And I think the BERTs is going to continue to be provoked, right, mm-hmm. by scholars to keep evolving, because we haven't resolved things and we don't have all the answers to the questions, and there are going to be more questions, and we can't, I think, even anticipate what some of those questions are going to be in the future.
And it's become a place to ask those questions and to have those discussions. Yes. Because it's receptive.
Yes.
Where other venues might not be as receptive to those types of things.
Yes, people have often said the feminists are hardest on themselves, right, in terms of our self-critiques. critique is important, questioning is important, and it's a place where that is invited and welcomed, even when it's agonizing. The theme for next year, I can tell you, because it was announced at the Little BERTs a couple of weeks ago, is the theme of the next Big BERTs to Hofstra University is difficult conversations. So there you go.
Yeah, that pretty much sums up the organization pretty nicely. And in terms of critiques, I did have one critique that I did tweet out after the conference was over. In University College, in the classrooms, I don't know if you're aware of this, I don't know if you teach in University College a lot, there are some really creepy posters of clowns.
I saw your tweet and I laughed. And
why are they there?
I did not even take in what they were advertising.
So it's to get people to not eat, maybe drink too, in classrooms.
Ah, and they used a sad clown or a creepy clown.
Clown to get this across. And the caption on the bottom says, feed your brain and not your mouth or something. And it's the clown with his mouth open.
Ah, okay. Well, yeah. You know, it wasn't part of our organizing efforts. So, but I can mention this. I did mention to my, you know, my colleague and partner, Ian Radforth, is based in University College.
Okay.
I showed him that tweet and he laughed. He said, yeah, I agree. Those are very odd posters.
The first thing I went to was the city's heritage department event. And I was sitting in one of the little lecture halls, and just the angle I was at, that poster was right over the shoulder of the speaker. And I really couldn't focus on what she was saying because all I could see was this clown staring at me. And every room I went to, or every classroom I went to in University College had one. So I finally had to take a picture of it and let people know that this was going on at the University of Toronto. But other than that, it was a delightful event. So,
well, thank you for that. And we were concerned about signage, you know, getting up those Brooks posters and arrows and so forth. And we're glad we had a lot of volunteers who were helping out. But we also know, you know, it's difficult to navigate those beautiful old buildings, too. They're lovely and they're beautiful, but they're always – I don't teach regularly in University College. And, you know, 24 years later, it's a beautiful building. It's a gorgeous building, but I still get lost because it's a bit of a maze.
Yes.
Right? I'm thinking, I end up – you know, getting turned around in it all the time.
Yeah.
You know, we wish too that, you know, accessibility standards were higher at U of T. So I'm going to put that in there too. And there are people who continue to work on accessibility issues. And I wish that we could really improve our efforts on that in that regard too.
Yeah. But with anything this size, there are going to be those sort of little issues that creep up. And I mean, the University of Toronto is, it's an old school with old buildings.
For us, it was a big issue because we cared about having a disability stream.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
For instance, of course, you want to be able to not isolate those things if those things come together. But yes, we were dealing with the reality of these old buildings. I should say, too, we talked a lot about issues around inclusivity with the LGBT stream, and we wanted to be clear that we were inclusive of transgender people at the conference. And transgender bathrooms and so forth. And all of that, again, you know, thanks to really to U of T folks who care about these things on an ongoing basis there, that was tremendously helpful because University College houses, you know, the sexual diversity programs. Mm-hmm. Hart House and UC run LGBT events all the time. This for them was not, you know, an issue in terms of a challenge to address. This was just for them what we do. And that was great because I can tell you that there was conversation about, you know, whether or not the conference would feel welcoming, right, to people who don't normally come,
right,
to Indigenous scholars, to transgender people. And that worked very well. And we got positive, you know, response to our efforts there. And it was great. And I felt very, you know, very, very good about that.
Yeah, and I think you should. I mean, and everyone who I talked to enjoyed it. And I certainly had a very good time and learned a lot. And I've kept you for 20 minutes past what I said I would. So for as much as I could continue to do this, I feel as though we should wrap it up because I don't want to take up too much more of your time. Any articles, books coming out, anything you want to talk about?
Oh. No, I'll just send out a plug for the various projects that are coming out of the Berks. I think it's important that the Big Berks not just be one event, but that it be an ongoing, you know, project and conversation. And so, you know, I'm part of a group doing a feminist oral history book along with Katrina Srigley and Stacey Zimbritsky. I'm working on this Pasadena panel with Donna Gabaccia, Mary Jane McCallum, and Sue Hiller, thinking through a potential book in Indigenous women and gender histories, coming, you know, with papers coming out of it. Joe Sharma is working on a theme issue dealing with South Asian, you know, women and gendered histories and so forth. And Rubenstein from New York working on a Caribbean one. So there are, you know, all sorts of ongoing projects that'll be great. And I'm finally, after a much interrupted, you know, 3 years of folks organizing, I am getting back to this book on the International Institute of Toronto, which is placed in a larger context international institutes that were created in the United States beginning in the 19-teens that were, in a sense, promoting pluralism, you know, at a time when it was very much a minority ideology, and that were people involved in pluralism well before, you know, Trudeau announced multiculturalism as official ideology in Canada in 1971. So I'm back to that.
Okay.
Thank you for asking.
So we can keep our eyes open for that. And anyone who's curious, Berks2014.com has the program, and it has some updates from since the conference. What's the website for the organization? Is it just BerkshireConference.com?
I think so.
Okay. So, or just Google up Berkshire Conference and you can see the organization as a whole and the work that they're doing, and sort of keep tabs on everything that's going on in the world of the Berks. And if you haven't heard the past episodes that I did from the Berks with Cynthia Enloe, Vereen Shepherd, and Ann Miller, at activehistory.ca, you can go under the podcast tab. There is a History Slam section of the website, and all of our episodes are there, so you can find those. Or if you just Google History Slam and the name of the person, you can find those episodes from the Berks. And like we say, I enjoyed doing those episodes, and I hopefully you will enjoy them as well. So that is Frankie Iacovetta, president, I guess now past president. Past president of the Berkshire Conference of Women Historians and the chair of the 2014 Berkshire Conference on the History of Women, which was held at the University of Toronto in May. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you very much.
If you have any questions or comments for the podcast, historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is @DrShawneeFever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.